What will it take to get Americans to fill up at the plug and not the pump? The Chevy Volt, the Nissan Leaf launched to big fanfares, but neither one is flying off the lot. In fact, the new smaller version of the Prius sold more cars in 36 hours than the Volt and the Leaf did combined in a month. Is it the price, the range, the design? Coming up, a look at electric car technology, from better batteries to local charging stations, including the new Coda, launched a week ago. Plus, romance, comedy, and science hit the big screen in a new movie, Losing Control. We'll chat with the director-writer Valerie Weiss about science in the movies and her own move from lab bench to director's chair. All coming up after this break, so stay with us. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos, too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When you fill up, is it regular, premium, or high voltage? When you bought your electric car or hybrid, people laughed at you as a tree hugger, didn't they? But with the price of gasoline approaching $5 a gallon, who's laughing now? In fact, even my local parking garage now has a charging station in it. Still, electric cars have barely made a dent in the total car population. There are several big players in the electric car market now, like the Chevy Volt, the Nissan Leaf, and more EVs from lots of car makers are on the way. But so far, the Volt and the Leaf haven't really been flying off the lot. A new smaller version of the Prius sold more vehicles in a couple of days than the Volt and the Leaf did all last month combined. So what would it take to get Americans to shift to electric? Is the time finally right now? How about the new Tesla Model S and the Coda? We'll be talking to somebody from the Coda later. Do you drive an electric car? You thinking about it? What's holding you back? Maybe you're ready to give it a try? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And you can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI, and you can go to our website at sciencefriday.com and our Facebook page, /SciFry. Seth Fletcher is a senior editor at Popular Science. He's also author of the book Bottled Lightning, Super Batteries, Electric Cars, and the New Lithium Economy. He joins us here in New York. Welcome, Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Don Carner is the chief innovation officer at Ecotality. That's a company that makes charging stations and other infrastructure for electric vehicles. He joins us from KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. It's great to be here and talking to you from sunny Phoenix.
Sunny Phoenix. Seth, the idea of an electric car, reading your book, is really not a new idea, is it?
No. In fact, you know, at the turn of the 20th century, electric cars competed for space on the road with gas-powered cars and steam-powered cars. And eventually, in fact, electric cars had an early advantage because they were much cleaner, and gas cars in those days were actually quite dangerous and dirty. But gas cars got better, and then electric cars have been traditionally limited by the range problem, which is just the fact that you can only drive so far on a charge of the batteries, and then it takes a really long time to recharge. And that has been the that's been the limiting factor for electric cars ever since, and that's just beginning to be overcome by advances in battery technology.
Well, like what is happening to make them go further?
It was really the advent of the lithium-ion battery that opened up the possibility of electric cars with performance that would be suitable for sort of mainstream American drivers. And it's just an adaptation of the same battery technology that's in our laptops and cell phones. And this has been happening for about the past 5 years, moving into the automotive industry. And the first cars that really fully used these batteries were the Nissan Leaf and the Chevy Volt, which went on sale about 6 months ago now.
Doesn't the Tesla have like 7,000 little laptop batteries in it, lithium batteries in it?
Yep, just under 6,000. And they are almost exactly the same thing that are bundled together in your laptop.
So you can just – what makes lithium such a good substance for a battery?
It's just the properties of the element itself. It's the lightest metal. It's the third element on the periodic table. And it's also highly reactive. It doesn't even exist in nature in its pure form because it's so reactive. And what that means is that you can build a light chemical system that contains a lot of energy. And that's what you want with batteries. You want them to be small. You want them to be light. You want them to be as highly energetic as possible. And so just the nature of the lithium atom makes it the perfect, well, you know, there are challenges with it, but it makes it about the best charge carrier we can possibly get for batteries.
Don Carner, I drive into New York every now and then, and I was shocked to see that there was a spot in the garage that said charging station right here in Midtown Manhattan. You're not shocked, I'll bet.
No, not at all. In fact, I'm very happy to see that. We're about at Ecotality. We're about putting those charging stations in and making electric vehicles mainstream, being able to have you charge where you lead the rest of your life, where you work and where you're entertained, where you shop, where you eat, and also where you sleep overnight at your home.
But is America, which wants to get up and go quickly, I mean, the charging stations take a half an hour to charge your car. Are they willing to hang out wherever they are for a half an hour?
Well, I think that's part of why we want you to be able to integrate charging your car in with the rest of your lifestyle. Rather than taking your car someplace specifically to charge, we want you to be able to charge where you lead the rest of your life. So if you go to work and there's a place where you can charge at work, the time that it takes is really irrelevant as long as that vehicle's charged when you're done with work. If you go to the store, if you go to the restaurant, that type of thing, you're really just dropping your car off. You happen to charge it at the same place that you're leading the rest of your life. We call that leading a Blink lifestyle. Blink is the product name for our chargers, and we really encourage people to learn how to integrate charging their electric vehicle in with the rest of the things they do in their life, much like you did with your cell phone when you first got a cell phone. You rapidly learned how to integrate that charging in with the rest of the things you do during the day, whether you charge it at night, you charge it on your desk during the day. But everybody started out with a little anxiety about, is my cell phone going to die before the end of the day? I'm going to miss a call. But very rapidly, you learned how to integrate that in with your life so that you didn't have an issue.
If you go to cold states like Alaska, Minnesota, places like that where people have warming elements in their cars for the winter. You plug your car in overnight, and they're in the parking lots of some universities. Why can't we have something like that, a little charger, wherever you're right in the supermarket, in the parking lot there, while you go in shopping, you plug your car in?
Well, Ira, I think you'll see exactly that. You're going to see chargers deploy into commercial space, shopping centers, grocery stores, barber shops, again, where people lead their lives, where they congregate, and where there's a concentration of electric vehicles. Our objective is to create a business model for electric vehicle charging such that those businesses are going to want chargers in their parking lots. Workplaces will want chargers there to support their employees, universities to support their students, and that an infrastructure deploys virally to support electric vehicles in the United States.
You know, Ira, I just wanted to follow up on one thing you said, that it takes a half hour to charge the car. If only it took a half hour to charge the cars from a normal wall outlet. This is actually one challenge, and there are three primary different types of charging. There's 110, 220, and 440. 440 volts are the fast charging stations that can recharge a battery in about a half hour. Those are expensive and require more electricity. So from the 220 volt, 220 outlet in your garage when you charge overnight, a car like the Leaf takes about 8 hours, which is why most people are going to be charging overnight.
But if you only used up a few kilowatt hours, whatever we want to call them, of charge when you went to the grocery store, you could sort of top off your battery.
Yeah, you could top off.
You could sort of top it off while you're going into, buying some broccoli or something.
Opportunity charging.
Yeah,
that's precisely why you would want an infrastructure available to people so that they have that choice. Yes, they can charge overnight at home, and that is kind of the preferred place to charge your vehicle. But at times, you'll want to top off at the grocery store using a 220 or level 2 charging. Other times, you may want to go to a fast charger and get a much faster charge to where in 15 minutes, you might be able to get 40 miles or so of additional range on your vehicle.
But, as Edison, who invented the American light bulb, what made him successful is not only did he have a light bulb, but he invented the whole system of delivering the electricity to that light bulb. We now have electric cars. How fast can we get the system to deliver the electricity to them? I mean, that's going to take some sort of statewide or local effort, is it not, Don?
Well, again, it goes back to the objective of creating a business model for charger hosts, those businesses, those people that will put chargers in. If there's a return on their investment, then there's a natural tendency as electric vehicles begin to concentrate in an area for these chargers to appear, much like any other business appears. Fast food pops up, grocery stores mm-hmm. pop up as population builds. At Ecotality, we're about building that business model and creating a return on investment for the charger hosts so that when they make that investment in a charger, whether it's dollar return, it's people across the threshold of their brick-and-mortar business, it's branding, advertising, that there's value that's returned to them. Because I don't think we can count on state or federal government to roll out an infrastructure for electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. It has to be rolled out on a viral basis because it makes good business sense.
Here's a tweet that came in from Tim Beauchamp. It says, why not inductive chargers under parking spaces and parking lots so that you don't have to even plug in?
And certainly that's an option, Ira. It's going to be more expensive because it's a more complicated system. And a decade ago, the General Motors EV1 and the Toyota RAV4s used an inductive charger, and that was used very successfully. Currently, the standard is for what we call a conductive charger, one that you actually plug in. And, of course, we've been plugging in electrical loads ever since Edison created the first power plant. It works very, very well. It's very safe, and it's inexpensive. Inductive charging may well be more convenient, and there are a number of companies in both the U.S. and Europe that are looking at coming out with inductive charging that can bring that convenience to the marketplace. And of course, as that rolls out, and if people want that convenience and they're willing to pay for it, certainly Ecotality mm-hmm. will, and I'm sure other companies will provide that to them.
Yeah, I would say, just to follow up on that, in the 90s, the lack of a charging standard was a pretty big mess and a pretty big obstacle to getting these cars deployed, on a large scale. And so the standardization that's happening this time around is a good thing.
Which we were all going to agree on the plug shape.
Exactly.
And things
exactly.
like that. That one will fit into the other. And before we go to the break, battery technology, is it really getting better?
It is getting better. It is steadily and slowly getting better and cheaper. I think that it wouldn't be wise to wait for a miracle battery to come out of nowhere. But, one hears interesting breakthroughs all the time. Something interesting recently has come from this company, Envia Systems, which is using two different types of electrodes, which is a steady advance. They say they can double the capacity of batteries today. That may be tall, but it's promising.
All right, 1-800-989-8255. If you want to talk about electric cars, talking with Seth Fletcher, senior editor of Popular Science. Spotted lightning, super batteries, electric cars, and the new lithium economy. Don Carner of Ecotality. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
Speak Spanish? Ahora, Science Friday, también en español. Encuentra lo mejor de la actualidad científica hispana y del mundo en sciencefriday.com/español.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the future of the electric car. Lots of tweets are coming in. Let me just read a few of them. I park across the street, Travis Poling says, from my house, so I can't run a cord from my house to my car. What if a passerby unplugs it? That's something interesting. EVs don't work for me, says Vincent Russell, because I live in an apartment complex, no garage to charge the car while I sleep. So what about renters? And other people, other people talking about the impact. And let me go to one call here on the phone from Ed in Shasta County, California. Hi, Ed.
Good morning. How you doing?
Hi there.
Hey, my main point would be, I guess, that I think I own a Leaf. I've been driving it pretty much exclusively, my only driving, for the last 10 months. And my perception is that there's a lot of confusion between the use and different charging needs of electric cars and hybrid or PHEV cars like the Volt. And my main point is that for electric cars, slow public charging, which are the vast majority of chargers out there, aren't very useful. To contradict what your guest from Blink said, what you need for an electric car, because it has a significant amount of range from your home at night, from wherever you charge it at night, you just have to be able to charge it occasionally on highways and freeways at a fast rate of speed to use it as your everyday driving vehicle. Completely different than a hybrid.
But if you had a, is this your only car that you have?
I actually have another car, and I've only driven it once to go to town to fill up the gas tank, literally. But, yeah, to do longer trips, you need a car.
Yeah. All right.
There are no charge stations on the freeways.
All right. Thanks for calling. An interesting point there. You need that.
And I wouldn't disagree with that. There's a combination of both, really, fast charge and the level 2 charging that's required to support battery electric vehicles and plug-in hybrid vehicles like the Volt to support those in commercial space. And again, some people are going to be perfectly fine with level 2 charging, charging at work, charging at movie theater, that type of thing. Others are going to require a faster charge, particularly along transportation routes where you may be going from one city to another. And people like Ed that are really dedicated to using their electric vehicle almost exclusively. And we are at Ecotality rolling out fast charging infrastructure as well as the level 2 right. infrastructure so that we can support both those kinds of drivers.
Let me bring on Chris Paulson. He's Senior Vice President, Corporate Strategy and Business Development at Coda Automotive. That's a startup EV manufacturer based in L.A. And today marks 1 week since the launch of their electric sedan. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Iris. Great to be here.
How have sales been going?
Well, since we just launched last week, we're just starting, but we have a lot of excitement. Our customers have lined up. We have reservations on the task right now, and we're working to fill them.
And describe your car for us. What makes your car different than the other electric cars?
Yeah, we're a five-passenger sedan, so we're the only all-electric sedan on the market today. We have a range of up to 125 miles, so that's quite a bit farther than some of the other cars on the road. That's an 88-mile EPA range. The EPA range is the standard that the Environmental Protection Agency uses to define how far a car goes. In our case, we expect that most drivers will exceed that 88 miles on a charge.
Mm-hmm. And how many cars do you expect to sell in a year?
Well, you know, it depends a lot on our ability to ramp up and our demand. We, in the long term, want to be a 10,000-unit-plus car company, which makes us a very small car company in the grand scheme of things. But because of the way that we've designed our company, we can sell cars profitably at a much lower number than some of the other car companies out there.
Do you have a lot of experience making electric cars?
Well, we are filled with EV people. One of the head of our battery division actually worked on the EV1, GM's EV1 program, and we've been working on EVs ever since. We have now, we're a small company, only 325 people, but the majority of those people are engineers and have been working on our EV now for 4 years and EVs in general for decades.
And how long does it take to charge your car, and will your car charge at a normal, quote-unquote, charge station?
Yes. We actually, along with a car, for most consumers, we'll install what we call an EVSE, similar to the product that Ecotality makes, in each garage. And that in that charger, you'll be able to recharge your car from empty to full in just under 6 hours. But for the average 40-mile commute, you can do that in just 2 hours.
Hmm. How are you going to compete with the other car companies, such a small company, 325 employees? How you compete with the GMs of the world?
First, we're going to continue to grow. So 325 is where we are today, but we'll have to be bigger to be able to compete in the long term. We have technology at our core. We're really a clean tech battery company first and a car company second. We understand how batteries work and how they integrate with electric vehicles in a way that, honestly, the big car companies are still developing in the capability to do. We will be able to launch cars quicker that are more efficient and work better with longer range. We think that is a real differentiator in the market. And once we have cars out there and people realize, hey, these cars are great, they're fun to drive, it's a totally different experience from an internal combustion engine car, and it's from a cool new brand called Coda Automotive, we think we can compete in the market.
Oh, yeah, and many parts of your car are made in China, and then you assemble them in California?
Yeah, the parts of the car are built all over the world. Our final assembly is in Northern California by the Port of Oakland. We have partners in China that help us develop the battery system. We have a joint venture there for the battery, and we also have a contract manufacturing relationship with a car company to do a lot of the assembly and then final assembly in the U.S.
What do you need? Do you need a new kind of battery? I mean, or we're talking about lithium batteries with Seth Fletcher, and see, that seems to be the state of the art now.
That's right, and as Seth would tell you, it takes a really long time to develop batteries and get them into cars. The lithium batteries have been in consumer electronics for 10 years or more, and now we're just starting to see them come into play for in vehicles. It takes 5 to 7 years to get a product from a consumer product to an auto grade. Lots of validation and proving that the batteries are safe and that they'll last the life of the car.
Now, electric cars cost more than gasoline-powered cars. How do you talk somebody into saying, this is better for you in the long run?
Well, the first thing I would say is most of the consumers that are buying cars this year, next year, and the year after have been wanting EVs for years, just like our caller a few minutes ago. He was waiting in line for his Leaf. That will sustain the launch of the industry. Then what we have to do is drive down price to get it closer to the cost of an internal combustion engine car. Our car, after the federal tax subsidies, is under $30,000. It's $37,002 MSRP. Remove the $7,500 federal tax credit gives you an under $30,000 car. And that car is at cost parity with equivalent IC cars in 3 years. We think to really go from the early adopters to the mass adopters, that we need to be able to get to that total cost of ownership point within 1 year. Mm-hmm. When that happens, consumers are deciding, should I buy this IC car that costs me about 20 cents a mile to drive, or should I buy an EV which is close to the same price that costs me 2 cents a mile to drive and is quiet and clean? And guess what? It's actually a lot of fun. Driving EV is a different experience. It has instant torque off the line. So when you get into the car and you hit the accelerator pedal, you feel like you're driving, in a lot of ways, a sports car.
Yeah, yeah. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Eric in San Francisco. Hi, Eric.
Hi. I'm on the air?
Yes, you are.
Yeah. I work for a Northern California utility in a service planning department, and I see that we're getting a lot of information with new EV vehicles. And so my question to you is, how are the car companies working with the local utilities to develop rates to help incentivize people to buy electric vehicles?
Yeah. Can you get a cheaper rate charging it overnight if you plug your car in? And actually, your car, if you have enough of them, becomes storage for electricity for around the country if you get enough electric cars with batteries in them.
So, Ira.
Yes, go ahead.
Definitely, as an infrastructure provider, Ecotality is working with utilities to try and figure out the best way to make electric transportation an asset to the grid rather than any kind of a liability. We generate a great deal of data from our chargers, which are all network connected, and gather data on 15-minute intervals on power and energy that's being used to charge. That information is available to utilities. In fact, we print quarterly reports that are posted to our website, theevproject.com. And it shows the load duration curves and how these chargers are being used and how much energy they're using, how much power they're using. And we are participating with the investor-owned utilities in California and the California Public Utilities Commission, looking at a number of aspects of charging, including charger ownership, charger rates, how to meter charging energy, and how to do that at the lowest possible cost for the ratepayers and the EV owners. So it is a very active topic with utilities, with their rate commissions, and with infrastructure providers like Ecotality.
Rhonda in Hendry County, Florida. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have a 5.2 kilowatt rooftop PV system, and we have lots more roof space. And I want to know, how much more do I need in order to plug a car in and charge it during the day? I sell back about 10 kilowatt hours every day. I don't really know the magnitude. I do worry about transferring the pollution from my tailpipe to the power plant. Our power is actually generated by coal where I live, and I don't want to transfer that pollution to where the coal plant has to make the power to charge my car. So I'd like to do it off my rooftop, but I'd like to know how much power do I need to do that.
Let me ask our guy from COTA. Chris, can he do that?
Our car is a 31 kilowatt hour battery car. Some of the other cars in the market go as low as 24 kilowatt hours, Rhonda. The one thing I would say about EVs versus internal combustion engine cars is they're actually a much more efficient usage of the power. So although you are transferring some of your emissions from the tailpipe to the source of coal, an electric motor is 95% plus efficient. So even if you do that, your overall emissions is lower, and it gives the utilities a chance to put renewable energy in place over time and slowly shift the mix to a better mix. In California, we have a very high proportion of renewable energy, and your emissions are significantly better.
Hey, good luck to you, Rhonda.
What capacity do I need on my house in order to do it, though?
Does she have enough excess?
So only that, I have 24. Okay, thank you very much.
Rhonda, yeah, okay.
All right, she's ahead of the curve. She's off the grid and ahead.
That's right.
Ahead of the curve. This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Chris Paulson, Seth Fletcher, Don Carner. Seth is author of the book Bottled Lightning, Super Batteries, Electric Cars, and New Lithium Economy. In a few minutes left, Seth, let me ask you about the conspiracy-type theories rumbling around that, you know, you hear that, oh, there aren't electric vehicles everywhere because the oil industry is stamping them out. But you write that one of the early innovators in lithium battery technology was at Exxon.
That's correct. In the late 60s and 70s, faced with the smog crisis in LA and then the various oil crises, everybody was into alternative energy, and including Exxon. Exxon was diversifying. They were going into office equipment and all kinds of things. And a guy named Stan Whittingham, working at an Exxon lab in New Jersey, actually developed the first usable rechargeable lithium battery, and that kind of set a bunch of other researchers on course to make it practical. So, I don't think that the conspiracy theories are correct.
Did you think that it's good that the gasoline is going up to $5 a gallon? And we get more people thinking about electric vehicles.
Well, I mean, let me put it this way. I think the success of electric vehicles depends on two things. One is the cost of batteries, and one is the price of oil. The higher the price of oil and the lower the cost of batteries, the more likely electric vehicles are to become attractive to a lot of people. And where those two numbers cross, I'm not exactly sure. But I don't really see oil getting any cheaper. Every time this year, we seem shocked that oil prices go up and anew, as if it's never happened before. And now we actually have a technology that should allow us to displace some oil if we can get the price of the batteries down.
Don, you agree?
Yes, I do. And there are obviously a number of other positive benefits from electric transportation, you know, pollution, energy security, that type of thing. But I don't think anyone likes the fact that the price of oil is going up. Certainly, it puts more of a focus on trying to provide alternatives to that. But we believe that electric transportation provides a whole variety of benefits that will provide that market pull that's going to make them successful.
Chris Paulson, you must be rooting for gas prices to be going.
Well, I think that gas prices are an important part of the economy and really do affect people. So it's hard for me to root for gas prices to go up too high. But you know, the reality is that long term, the price of oil will only go up. And we believe that even creating a hybrid garage, where you have an EV in your garage and you have a car that you use for longer trips, will substantially reduce the oil usage in America. And our goal is to have an EV in every garage in America.
Do you think that's practical? Do you think that actually might happen, Seth?
Well, I'm convinced it will. It's not a this is not a next year thing. And you know, it seems like there's been a small number of EVs sold so far, and compared to the overall the economy, that's true. But if you compare it to the launch of hybrids 10 years ago, it's right on line with that, and I think you'll see slowly that growth expand. And at a point in the future, I believe that EVs will be a common decision that people make.
Seth, will the batteries we have now make that possible, or are we going to need newer batteries?
We're going to need better batteries, but you know, one important thing to note here is that the term lithium-ion battery or lithium battery, that's a big umbrella covering a lot of different sub-strains of batteries. And so what scientists are working on right now, in addition to coming up with new blue sky breakthroughs, is to just squeeze every bit of capability out of the basic lithium battery configuration we can.
Well, we've run out of time. We'll always keep following this topic. Chris Paulson is Senior Vice President, Corporate Strategy and Business Development at Coda Automotive. Seth Fletcher, Senior Editor at Popular Science, author of Bottled Lightning, Super Batteries, Electric Cars and the New Lithium Economy. Don Carner, Chief Innovation Officer at Ecotality. Thank you, gentlemen, for
taking
time to be with us today.
Thank you, Ira.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk with the writer and director of a new movie where science is central, and it's a sort of an interesting take on it. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Ira here with a quick reminder to upgrade your iPhone and iPad app. We're adding all kinds of new features. We're making the app easier and more enjoyable to use. Flora's videos look just gorgeous on the iPad. You've made suggestions, we've listened to them, and over the coming days, please check iTunes and search under the keywords Science Friday. A newer, better app is waiting for you to download on iTunes. And we haven't forgotten you Android users. The updated Android app will be right behind. Now back to the show. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. Can a science experiment find you the right mate? A new romantic comedy film opens in New York today. It's called Losing Control, and the main character is a scientist, Samantha, played by Miranda Kent. She is working on her PhD at Harvard, and she's also trying out sort of her love life at the same time. But unlike the stereotypical scientists we see in movies or on TV, Samantha isn't – she's not one of these super nerds with the dorky glasses, the frizzy hair. She's a regular person, maybe a tiny bit quirky, but who isn't, right? So how did that happen? Is Hollywood finally getting the message that scientists can be smart and sexy? Or maybe it takes a scientist to make a movie that doesn't rely on stereotypes. Joining me now to talk more about the film Losing Control is Valerie Weiss. She wrote, directed, and produced the film. And we have a clip of it that we're going to listen to right now.
You are going to break your neck.
No, I'm not. The centrifugal force keeps us from falling off.
Sam.
My mom doesn't understand science, but she knows that the inward force of us holding onto each other balances the outward force that makes us feel like we're falling off.
Whee!
I'm having a heart attack.
Don't worry. It's science. It always works.
Well, at least it used to.
Great segue from the kids to the rotating little, what was that?
To the centrifuge.
Centrifuge.
From the roundabout to the centrifuge.
Tell us about the plot of the movie.
Well, really, I just wanted to make a movie about a centrifuge because I've never seen a centrifuge in a movie before. But so as you said, it's a quirky romantic comedy about a female scientist who wants proof that her boyfriend is the one.
Yeah. So she does a science experiment with her boyfriend.
Exactly. She spends so much time in the lab doing experiments, it just seems second nature to answer her life questions that way as well.
Mm-hmm. And this is a movie that stars a female scientist in the main role. She's working at a PhD in Harvard. You have a PhD from Harvard. A little bit of a coincidence?
Well, they say write what you know. And after 6 years getting a PhD, I knew it really well.
But you were not you never became a scientist, did you?
Well, I mean, it depends what you mean. I had been doing science since I was 14, working in labs. And, you know, I did a whole PhD in X-ray crystallography. So I definitely, you know, considered myself a scientist. But I didn't work at it after my PhD. I made my first movie while I was writing my PhD. And 2 weeks after we wrapped, I defended my thesis and never did another experiment again.
What was the tug to the theater side?
You know, I think I'm attracted to both fields because I love to know why things are the way they are. And, you know, relationships or theater gets at, you know, relationships and personalities and, you know, social aspects of our lives. And then, you know, I discovered science in 10th grade because I had a great biology teacher, Mr. Sharon Bura. And
there's always somebody, isn't there?
It's, you know, science teachers are so important. Someone has to really, like, introduce you to it because it's not necessarily immediately accessible in our culture, and except for shows like yours. And, you know, then I realized that's another way to ask why. And I could get down to the molecular level of why things are the way they are. So that's really the tug for both fields.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking with Valerie Weiss, writer, director, and producer of Losing Control that opens in New York today. You know, a little nervous?
Sure. I mean, we've been in festivals for a year. We've screened in 30 film festivals, and we screened for the National Academy of Sciences. So I know audiences love it. So that takes some of the nerves away.
But did you get support from the science community?
We got amazing support. A company called VWR that scientists will know because they furnish everything in your lab, and Eppendorf and Corning and a whole list of other companies were amazing. They filled our – we had a lab from Zencor in Los Angeles that let us shoot for free.
In their lab.
In their lab.
It looks like a real lab.
Thank you. It was so important to me to have authenticity in this movie. And they gave us an empty lab because, of course, they didn't want us messing with experiments. And that was great, except we had to fill it on no budget. So these companies donated equipment to us for free. It was amazing.
How did you decide on the character, the lead character, the scientist, what she would her character be? Not the nerdy kind of science person you might see on The Big Bang Theory.
Yeah. Well, right? You know, like I said, authenticity was so important, and I was lucky enough to have access to this world because it was my life for six years. And, you know, I just based her on myself and my friends, and she, you know, my class was actually 50% women, and the women weren't like the stereotypes you see in movies. They were real and vulnerable and had boyfriends and lovers, and, you know, I just wanted people to get to see that. And so really I just, you know, based it on my own experiences. Mm.
And did you – the plot, was that based on your own experience?
It's definitely exaggerated. My favorite filmmaker is Pedro Almodovar, and a movie called Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown was a huge inspiration for me. And I love that sort of zany, absurdist comedy. So, you know, things are embellished, but there's a kernel of truth to everything, and the science is 100% accurate in the movie.
1-800-989-8255 is our number if you'd like to talk about the movie Losing Control with Valerie Weiss. You say the science is 100% accurate.
Yeah, there's one scene maybe we fudge it a little, but it's towards the end.
I bet you I know what that is.
Don't give it away. Don't give it away. Yeah, well, I'm not a physicist. I'm a biophysicist.
I thought this can't happen.
Maybe in an alternate universe.
I won't give it away, but we all of us who have seen the movie say there's a little bit of fudging going on in this spot.
Yeah,
there.
But it was too good not to put it in. It made me laugh too hard.
Did you have to teach the actress how to do the pipetting and all that kind of stuff?
You know, we did. We spent so much time because, again, it was so important to me. We had science consultants from UCLA and Zencor. Actually, my actors who play scientists, they came to the lab, they ran a gel, they pipetted, they did everything. They spent a whole day learning. They went to lab meetings. They actually spent probably a week of intensive training, and they were amazing. I think they're really convincing.
How much of the science did you feel you needed to dumb down?
You know, nothing. I didn't dumb down a thing because I think if you understand science, you can explain it well. And I know Alan Alda is going to talk about that. And I took a workshop with him about communicating science. And I think, you know, it's a matter of A, finding what's personal about it, B, understanding it yourself, and C, connecting with your audience. So the only thing we did was find visual ways to explain the same concept. So, you know, there's a scene where she's at a party and she uses elements on the bar to explain her research with, you know, X and Y chromosomes. And, you know, audiences get it. It's so rewarding.
Yeah, they want as much science as you can give them.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. They just keep begging for more. Not sex. It's science. Give us more science.
There you have it. That was sort of a scene out of A Beautiful Mind. Like they were in the bar and they were also in another bar.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. It's just,
did you have that in mind at all, the other great scenes in films that were you would become part of the lore?
We have some pretty memorable lab scenes. We're hoping we go into the great canon of science movies for what we put in there.
All right, let's take a phone call or two from Christine in Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Christine.
Hi, I'm so disappointed by this movie. I'm a graduate student at Duke, and we've struggled so long to not, I guess, the main thing is not to sexualize women, especially in science. I mean, the documentary misrepresentation just talks about that.
Have you seen the movie? Christine?
I haven't, but based on the conversation, I mean, explaining science on a bar, I mean, Ira, I enjoy your show, but you got so excited about equating sex and women in science. It's just so disappointing and disgusting. It really is.
Well, okay.
Christine, you need to see the movie because I don't think you'll be disappointed. I think what you'll see is it's the first time a full picture of a real woman is presented because her brain is absolutely there and she's an emotional, breathing, real person. And I think you'll actually be very happy when you see it. Check out the trailer at losingcontrolmovie.com. It'll give you a really good taste for it.
But you've mentioned sexiness in science 4 times. Why does that?
I also mentioned her research at Harvard, her PhD, the X and Y chromosome. You really should take a look.
Yeah, but we all know the history about sexism and women in science. I mean, all of that kind of effort kind of negates what we're trying to achieve.
I don't think it will. I think you need to take a look. As a good scientist, do your research before drawing conclusions.
1-800-989-8255. How many places will this be opening after?
We're starting in 6 cities. We're starting in New York.
She wants to go see it.
Yeah. Well, now we have to go to Durham for sure. we are starting in New York. Then we go to Boston. And actually, this is out of chronological order. But we go to Boston April 6th at Kendall Square Cinema. We're really excited for our hometown screening. And in Los Angeles, we open April 13th at the Lemley Theater, and we're going to be in Sacramento and Tempe and Tacoma. And that's just a start. All these places are chains, so we're hoping to expand across the country if we have your support and you come out and see the film.
Now, you must have a sequel or another movie.
Oh, we have a TV show, actually.
A TV show?
In the works. Yeah, we think this is a great episodic story where there's a whole other element that's happening in the lab besides her love life, and we're gonna sort of make it an Ally McBeal-ish sort of episodic thing.
Interesting. You know, you ever hear of Leon Letterman? He's still a physicist. He spent decades going to Hollywood trying to convince Norman Lear and people like that, who are very big TV producers, to do a TV series based in a laboratory someplace.
Somebody told me this story. This was a long time ago,
Oh,
right?
Well, I'm old enough to remember because I've known Leon forever. So
maybe Joe Palka told me. Somebody told me this story.
Could be. If you can pull that off, you know, what the modern version of it, of course, is CSI.
Right.
They got their lab, but they had to disguise it.
Right. Well, I think the character-driven element needs to be in there. And, you know, before we made this movie, they said the same thing. They're like, nobody wants to see scientists, and nobody, you know, we have to dumb down the science. And they told me science wasn't visual, which I take huge issue with because it's a very visual movie, and we found lots of ways to show the science.
Who were the they that told you these things?
You know,
the
just
producers,
different people.
The industry?
Industry a little bit. You know, we met with people who really wanted the movie to be about a scientist who created a potion to find the right man. And, you know, I was like, you know, science is advanced enough. We understand it enough. We can use real science to explore this question. We don't need to make it up.
Well, we wish you good luck and in your opening. And, you know, we talk a lot about science and theater and film here. And we always hope that they find some legs so everybody can go see them. They get wider distribution. So people can call us after they've seen the movie.
Great.
And talk
about it. Thank you. Yes. Let us know after you watch it.
Good luck to Valerie Weiss. She is losing control here. She's wrote, directed, and produced the film, and it's a good view. I advise you all to go take a look. Thank you for coming and
thanks
talking
for having
with us
me.
Today.
It's a pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Joining us now is Flora Lichtman, our multimedia editor. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
What have you made for us this week?
This is a fascinating one, I think.
They're all fascinating.
Oh, okay, thanks. this one really I had to give a lot of thought to. It comes from Bradley Smith, who's in the School of Art and Design at Michigan, at the University of Michigan. But he has a PhD in anatomy and sort of specializes in medical visualization. And back in the 1990s, the NIH funded him, to make a collection of images of human embryos. And he thought that he was doing this sort of for the clinical community. You know, the idea was to take MRI scans of embryos, and these are from a museum, by the way, the Museum of in D.C. of Health and Medicine, and to make them accessible for medical students and so they wouldn't degrade. And it turned out that when he put them online, which was part of his funding agreement, that he got all sort of you know, strong reaction from the public.
Right. The videos of the embryos.
The videos of the embryos. He does sort of a time lapse of human development. And it was really fascinating to watch, going from this sort of little hard to, you know, nondescript ball
right.
to what you would recognize
as an embryo.
As an embryo or a fetus.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Flora Lichtman about our video pick of the week, and it's out of videos of embryos,
yes.
all different kinds of embryos. So you got the film, the footage,
right? So,
and you put your own video together out of this.
Right. So he has this whole collection of different embryos at different stages, and you measure age of embryo based on its post-ovulatory age. So it's very hard to tell exactly when the embryo was conceived, but you can kind of estimate based on ovulation. And so you look and you can see after 28 days what it looks like after mm-hmm. 42 days. And he's put together actually these sort of amazing time lapses. You can watch these changes over time. And in talking to Smith, he's really thought a lot about why we have such a strong reaction to looking at embryos. And he's found this firsthand. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, he gets emails all the time and sort of unpacks these questions. Like, you know, is it when you look at these pictures, does it strike you as more human or less human than you would have imagined? He asks. This is what he asks the audience when he shows them. What is your experience with seeing these pictures in the past? You know,
right.
he said, imagine 300 or 400 years ago. How would people imagine what an embryo is? This is a technologically
yeah. Yeah.
mediated experience.
And not only that, he's taken the technology further, as you show. He's done MRIs.
That's right.
So he's never seen before.
No one had ever done this before. And you can see the sort of whole internal structures. You can watch organs develop, the neural tube. And I think, you know, he made the point, it didn't break much new ground scientifically. People understood a lot of this already. But now it gives medical students, for example, an opportunity to look through and ask questions without actually destroying an embryo to answer them.
Mm-hmm. It was a new experience for you to take these and put these together. He really hadn't done this in any...
Yeah, so he has a website which has most of these images up there, and we have a link to it on our website if you want to keep perusing or learn more about the different stages. But yeah, it became a challenge to sort of figure out what the story was. But the other interesting thing about Dr. Smith is that, you know, he did this years ago, and he still gets, like, thousands of hits per week. People are just mm-hmm. fascinated by these images, but he also has taken them and turned them into art pieces.
Yeah, his artwork ends the video, and it's a very thoughtful video. You know, you've done some that are just splashy. This is a very thoughtful one. Get you thinking about it.
It took a lot of thought to figure out exactly, you know, what I was looking at and why I was having a reaction to
yeah.
these pictures.
And so it's our video pick of the week. It's up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. Go take a look and then have your own reaction to it and leave us a message there on our website, where you can tweet us all week and leave us a message also that way. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
Our program senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata and Amisha Serene Anand. Luis Quevedo is our Spanish language producer. Sam Flatow is our production assistant. Neil Rausch is our technical director. I'm Ira Flatow. Thanks for listening.